And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Race IndyCar podcast, where, as if we didn't have enough to chat about with everything that was going on track on the Indianapolis road course weekend, we had another installment of the Alex Palou saga to keep us interested off track as well. So welcome along to the show. We'll try and round out what we'll get into on the show this week. We'll obviously look at Scott Dixon's brilliant lap one crash to victory performance over the course of the race there. We'll definitely get into that. We'll also look at Joseph Newgarden also being involved in that crash and that effectively ending his title fight, although we'll get JR's thoughts on if he thinks he's still in it or not, as we like to do that quite regularly. We'll also talk about Graham Rahal ending a six-year spell of no poles with a delivery of a lovely qualifying lap. He got very close in Mid-Ohio. I think he was, well, he was well under a tenth off pole in Mid-Ohio earlier this year and made good on that pole with a bit of a surprise performance, I guess. We know how good Rahal can be on the Indianapolis road course, but it's not always Graham you expect to be the one popping it on pole with Christian Lundgaard, previously the kind of guy to watch there. So we'll get into that. And of course, we'll outline everything surrounding the Alex Palou situation, what we know, what we think about the whole thing, and what we think is probably going to happen next. So hello, JR Hildebrand at first. How are you doing? Are you well?
Yeah, good, man.
JR's alongside to break down all of the action from the weekend. We should start with Scott Dixon, who, as I mentioned, was caught up in that lap one crash, which was, I guess, kind of triggered by Alex Palou's optimistic move on Marcus Armstrong, which kind of made a bit of a chain reaction at turn seven. And although that is a wide corner, when you've already got cars three or four wide going into the corner, it can get narrow pretty quick when you've got cars flying all over the place. Joseph Newgarden was one of the guys caught up. He hit one of the stationary cars there. Romain Grosjean did the same thing as well. He was also caught up. And yeah, Dixon was involved. But one of the things that we've seen happen at this race multiple times before is people pitting inside the first kind of 10 laps and trying to turn it into either like a long final stint or hoping that a caution's going to give them the time back that they lose and the pit stop's going to help with fuel or tyres or whatever. So we saw Dixon pit on lap five. He went really long in his first two stints after that. And then the last stint was really long for him as others around him kind of pitted and he cycled to the front. JR, we saw multiple people have a go at this strategy in the race for various different reasons. We saw people fail on it. I thought Romain Grosjean was going to be the one who we should maybe watch because he pitted like basically right with Dixon on that lap five. And we've seen how good Romain's been at Indy before. But I guess we kind of got a reflection of a little bit of what it's like to cover Ganassi and Andretti this season in that exchange, because Ganassi gave Dixon a perfect pit stop and he emerged out with a chance to move forward, and Roman's left rear wouldn't go on properly. Really struggled, fell back and was way out of contention for the rest of the race. And that one pit stop could have changed the whole race for Romain. He could have been in the top five or the top 10 as well, and obviously wasn't. But I guess getting back to Dixon, the point I want to make with this is we've talked about this at length, usually when we talk about Alex Palou through the course of this season. We've spoken a lot, haven't we, about how alternate strategies don't work unless the driver is able to match that with pace. And it sounds like a very obvious thing to say out loud, but I think people sometimes give too much praise or put too much emphasis on a strategy when it's actually the driver obviously delivering the pace to match that strategy that really puts them in victory lane. But I guess in this occasion, it's slightly different with Dixon because it's not necessarily just the pace that did it for Scott. It's the tyre management and the fuel saving that we've seen him have. We've seen him do this many times before. I don't feel like we've seen it particularly, he's not won a race this season, so we haven't seen it happen this year for sure. But a nice reminder of what he's capable of. It definitely feels like Honda have either made a step at some point through the season or have been particularly strong in general on fuel saving this year. But even so, we saw other Honda powered guys trying this strategy and not really being able to make it work. So I wanted to get your kind of insight from a driver's perspective of, obviously, Dixon's got three very strong teammates who can look at his data over a course of a race. So there'll be things they can pick up from that in terms of fuel saving and tyre management, I imagine. And I guess there's a certain amount of data knocking around for all the teams and drivers. And the actual art of fuel saving seems to be, in some ways, relatively straightforward. Like, there's not a million things that you can do to get an advantage on other drivers. So maybe from a driver appreciation point of view, you know, how difficult is it to do what Dixon does, where he has these races where he's able to save so much fuel and tires compared to everybody else sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, I think first I would just echo some of your thoughts, you know, in the lead up here, which are basically, I think to have this situation, like if you had spin in the first, you know, five laps, go to the back pit, and if you had those on your bingo card, you needed Scott Dixon and Ganassi and Honda to hit bingo at this event, basically. Like, I think that that's for various reasons, but I think that that's kind of because you saw that, like, you saw other drivers, you saw other teams, I think that, to your point, we've kind of heard some behind the scenes about Honda making what has been perceived in the paddock to be maybe coming into the season feeling like Honda was better off on fuel economy just to start with, basically, but then widening that gap over the course of the season. We've seen Chevrolet produce some performance that maybe they didn't have. So sometimes those things just, you know, you focus on one thing and not the other, and you can't get both, basically. So that may be the case. But it just struck me that you really didn't see anybody on the Chevy side even try this. And I think, reading between the lines, like Pato's interview at the end, after post race, he's him basically saying, just we quote unquote couldn't have done what Dixon did. Basically, I think that was kind of a veiled, like, we just can't get that fuel mileage, basically. Like, it's not like we can't make the tires last or whatever. And so, like, part of it is just, can you get to the end of the race and not be, I think Scott would have been, given where they were at, I was sort of watching through the second stint of that race, or his, I guess, second stint, everybody else's basically third stint going into the final pit stops, just thinking, I don't know, like, there's enough of the top five cars on the traditional strategy were spread out enough that you sort of felt like, okay, well, Scott's going to end up in the top five here, and they're going to be stoked for that. As long as he makes it to the end of the race and they're not spacing this out such that he's going to have a more dramatic fuel number to hit in the third, you know, in his third stint, basically, after his final pit stop. And so I think to your point, to actually answer your question, to talk about, like, what does it take to actually end up winning this race? Like, to do all the things that he did, to basically be on the back foot, to be pulling, to be trying to pull off a strategy that nobody else has managed to do, and that clearly a bunch of people just completely ruled out, you know, like, this was not on the radar of a lot of people because they just didn't feel like they could do it in the first place. This starts to get into what Scott Dixon really is exceptionally good at. And it's not just fuel saving. It's basically driving the car in the most efficient possible way, given it kind of being imperfect, or you being in an imperfect situation. And I would say, I think there's part of that ability and that skill set and the feeling that he's able to work with from the car in these kind of situations that is not entirely different from the reason that he's been on pole at Indianapolis so many more times than everybody else. It's just because he's able to, with his inputs, into the steering wheel in particular, but brake pedal, you know, obviously at Indy, you're not using the brakes, but, you know, just his steering inputs, basically, if we just talked about that, his ability to really, it's not like maximizing what the car is going to give you without going over. It's almost like kind of preemptively being able, he just has a smoothness about the way that he does these things that it's really deliberate. And so he makes a deliberate input. Yes, he's reacting to what the car is doing, but I think of all of the things that we see, like in contrast to say Pato O'Ward, who we know is ultra fast, ultra quick hands, like very, if there's a problem, he's your guy to be able to fix it. Like if somebody's out there and they got to just like hang on to the thing by sawing at the wheel, like Pato's your guy. But Scott manages maybe to drive the same car just without having to have it right on the ragged edge. Like he just has this kind of sixth sense, I think, for the car being loose, the car not really being perfect, not doing what he wants it to do, and being able to operate like a fraction of a percent, like under the limit of the car, to be able to get all the way to the end, to be able to get to the end of lap four in a qualifying run, to be able to get to the end of these stints without just completely burning the thing up. And so that's actually, to me, when I watch these kinds of situations, that's really what stands out the most. I can definitely recall thinking, you know, I remember a Barber race, and it must have been 5 or 6 years ago. Scott didn't win the race because I think he still hasn't won a race at Barber. He's finished second. Like, isn't that one of the tracks that he's finished second at, like, you know, 8 times or something? You know, watching his onboard in a fuel safe situation in the middle of the race, clearly the rear tires are just completely smoked. Like the car was set up loose to start with, and the rears have burned off. And it's like, if you just watch his steering inputs, you wouldn't really be sure exactly which direction the track is going one way or the other. Or even when a corner is coming around, because he's just like, he's never got more than 10 degrees of steering in the thing. You just kind of have, you almost have to try to put yourself in that position and think, okay, it's that on the edge. This guy just with the sort of finesse of his hands and not ever making really sharp inputs with the brake and throttle. He's just blending those three inputs together everywhere so seamlessly that a car that somebody else would have crashed in long ago, he's still managing to like hang in there in second and stick the thing on the podium. And so the fuel save part of it, to your point, the kind of macro strategies to saving fuel are pretty basic. Like you lift and coast at the end of the straightaway. At Indianapolis, it's a place where you can definitely save a fair amount of fuel because there's three real heavy braking zones. There's also, I would say, like going into turn four is just kind of another spot going into, I guess it's 13, that before you come onto the front straightaway, the left where pit entry is. Those are 4 and 13 are both additional braking zones that maybe you could almost get away with just like a long lift instead of braking into those corners. And because you're not, especially once you get halfway through a stint, by doing that, if the car is set up such that it's free enough, basically, that you don't need to transfer all that weight onto the nose of the car to get it to turn, which we know Scott Dixon tends to drive a car that at least can be kind of migrated into that window, probably with the cockpit tools. Those are both places where you're probably not completely deleting a braking zone, but you can brake a lot lighter, use those places as another lift and coast while still maintaining kind of tire energy, cornering energy. You're not losing a ton of lap time, basically, once you're partway into a stint to be able to, get a little bit more fuel save going. So I say all of that just to say there's a lot of places at this track in particular that, you know, you might not be losing a lot of time to be saving a little bit of fuel in a bunch of spots, but it's what it really comes down to is to maximize that, to do what Scott does. It's a lot more of the first thing that I was talking about, which is, okay, everybody can lift and coast. Extracting the lap time that's in it while you're lifting and coasting has much more to do with just that transition between all of your different inputs and still being able to get everything out of it and being able to make the car last not only on fuel, but tires to the end of these stints. And so that's why I think it's kind of this, you maybe had to have this perfect combination of these parts, this driver, that team to, you know, to your point about Grosjean, to not screw up a pit stop, to commit clearly to this strategy without yellows from the very beginning. That's kind of a ballsy call to make right away. In some ways it's not. In some ways it's like the only call to make, but much easier to say, all right, we're going to like kind of be somewhere in between here and assume that we'll get some yellows. Which clearly some other people kind of were more on that front with the whole thing. Just to do all of those things and actually end up winning this race is really incredible. And it's kind of one of those weird things with Scott that I think part of the reason why he's earned so much respect, or why he just possesses so much respect from all of the other drivers that he's competed against for 20 years and, you know, the teams and the engineers and the mechanics. I mean, everybody that's inside the paddock that's raced against Scott Dixon is because you just realize that for better or worse for him on a larger scale in terms of recognition of Scott Dixon's, you know, skill and greatness at large, the things that he really does so exceptionally well are he's kind of like a silent killer with them. You know, like they're just these things that kind of go under the radar to the average person, go under the radar to the casual fan. But when you're in it and you're doing it at the same time as you're trying to do the same thing that he's doing at the same time, that's really what, you know, makes you realize how incredible he is. So I was excited for him. I was glad that, you know, as I've said before on the pod, I guess I just think that for that reason, I'm always excited to see Scott Dixon get celebrated or have an opportunity to get celebrated because he's, you know, I think so much of what makes him as incredible as he is just not as obvious as it is for other people, basically.
It was amazing to me, shocking in some ways, because I guess we've seen that kind of performance from Scott on so many occasions, but it's usually like he's coming from, you know, a poor qualifying and he manages to finish like fifth or sixth or seventh or something, you know, like he's making lemonade out of lemons, right? Like he's had a long day and he's pulled off a strategy like that, but it never, or not never, but it rarely feels like he's going to win from that scenario. Especially when it's like only him who's like really trying to make it work. And he's like the kind of one-off in the scenario. Like I remember Portland with Palou a few years back when they all went off at the first corner and there was like seven or eight guys on that strategy. And you're like, there's a reason why these guys have committed to this. Like they really think they can make it work.
I was going
to
bring up Portland as kind of a race that this reminded me of a little bit, but yeah, with a much harder fuel save to have to hit, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess the shocking aspect of it for me was that Graham just looks so good on the hard tire. And I don't know if you had the same kind of feeling as me, but we know that race control have moved towards this kind of strategy of not like pulling a caution immediately after an incident. They've kind of tried to wait for people who haven't pitted to give them a chance to get into the pits before they call the caution. And I just thought that played really nicely into Graham's hands because he knew he could stretch a stint and not have to worry so much about being blasted by an Indy road course caution that we've seen in the past that totally takes people out of, in fact, it's taken him out of the potential of winning a race before in, I think, 2020 or 2021. But with that kind of out of the window and kind of knowing how race control are going to police that and let everyone pit before calling a caution, I just felt like all of the kind of cards were in Graham's hands, especially when we saw how quick he was on the hard tire compared to pretty much everybody else. And that just seemed like everything was kind of falling in his favor. And then suddenly, you know, a combination of all these things that we've talked about for Dixon, but also just how long he was able to stretch the stints and keep the pace up to the level that he was the reason why he obviously had that gap to play with once he came out after his last stop and he was able to I guess hold Graham off. It was just shocking in the sense that I guess you kind of expect this level of performance from Dixon, but it just looked like all of the cards were stacked against him, and this was going to be a brilliant comeback drive to like seventh or something that we've seen him do so many times.
Yeah, I think I found myself thinking once we got into the final stint of the race that I was kind of like, I wonder if the Rahal guys just didn't even factor in Dixon as like a genuine threat for the win. Like it makes me wonder if post-race, if they were kicking themselves at all, and maybe not. The answer to this might be no, that they didn't really have through call it the previous stint in particular, where you would have at least recognized like, okay, we're in for some degree of convergence here. Like Dixon is a factor, if nothing else. Like you'd have had a whole stint worth of his data and pace to kind of start to play with a little bit in the, you know, bigger scheme of where everybody's at. But it seemed in a way so easy for Graham to do what he was doing for a long period in the race. It makes you wonder, like, I wonder if all he needed was a couple of seconds worth of lap time over the course of like two stints, basically, to have changed the outcome of this race. I found myself feeling a little bit bad that they'd even be thinking that, basically, you know, like, oh man, that would really be a bummer to be, you know, sitting in that spot and thinking, oh man, like, yeah, we kind of took our foot off the gas because we thought we were just racing the guys behind us. So
not a bummer, but a bummer, as Graham Rahal put it himself.
Yeah, right.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
All right, just quickly before we get to Graham, and I guess we'll mention his teammate Christian Lundgaard as well briefly. Joseph Newgarden, JR, basically a nightmare weekend from start to finish for him, especially in the race where, yeah, he was taken out in that early incident, and without any cautions, he just wasn't able to get that lap back or produce any sort of comeback strategy like Dixon was able to, unfortunately. This leaves him, I think he's 108 points out now with three races to go. So, it looks pretty uphill. Obviously, Scott Dixon's win takes him past Joseph in the points. We know that Polo can win the championship with 2/10 and a 9th over the last three races. There's multiple ways he can wrap up the championship, both in Gateway and Portland. I think that'll be the first time since 2005 that the championship's not gone to the last round. I think Weldon, unless it's happened since then and escaped me, but I'm pretty sure that's right. So that would be, that would be a shame. I think at this point, kind of like hoping that Dixon finishes second so that Newgarden doesn't have another year finishing second, because I just don't think he deserves that. Even if third is worse than second, it feels like at this point it's better than finishing second, judging by the last 3 years. What do you see in terms of, I guess I wanted to ask you this in the context of, we know he's going to be, or we think he's going to be strong at Gateway because you know, he won the last race there. He's won a million oval races in a row, it feels like. And that's a place where he should be able to turn up and have a strong race. But for me, it just feels like even if he wins that race, I just don't really see his way back into it now. I think he's too far out.
No, I think just given the races that are on the schedule in particular, also, like, Gateway is any oval race, obviously, as we've seen, but I think for other reasons than just performance, like, they're definitely places that are easier to just have a race ending incident of some kind, it feels like, than and that not having to be something that is totally out of your control as an otherwise very competitive driver, right? And so I think that's really how I look at some of those races, just in terms of what are the odds of something weird happening or something, you know, really devastating in terms of your finishing position. Like, the ovals are all, they're all just places. Every oval that we go to now is a place that even top drivers in the series could just have a single car accident all by themselves that takes them out of the race. I feel like the likelihood of that happening on any of the ovals in the IndyCar schedule is higher than it is that it happens at basically any of the other places. So for that reason, Gateway could be a place where you have a much more varied set of results. But I think the gap at this point, this is obviously not rocket science here, like, the gap at this point is just great enough that probably doesn't matter. And then we're going to Portland and Laguna, which are both places that Pelot has been great at. So you're really depending on Alex to have just all, I mean, he's basically got to not finish all three of these races for anybody to genuinely be in contention again. And that while Scott or Joseph, like, if that happened, Scott or Joseph could both be top five guys at all three of those places. Neither of them, frankly, strike me as the obvious candidate to go dominate all three of them, like, to go on a run and win the last three events of the year. And so I I've sort of been thinking that this is over for a little while now, but now it's just, I think just the math of it doesn't really make any sense. I think it's more likely that Alex locks this thing up before they get to Laguna than it is that anybody else, you know, than Scott or Joseph basically are still in it. A weird weekend for Joseph and the Penske guys, just kind of in general, almost seems like they were kind of admittedly just off and maybe don't 100% know why at this particular track. They've had a hard time. This is the place where you see the three of the cars kind of the most all over the place. It seems like there's not a lot of consistency between Power and Joseph and McLaughlin in terms of their performance at IMS on the road course. You know, part of that is a 10th is 8 spots or something in qualifying around here. It's just kind of a short lap. It's a relatively straightforward track. So if you're a tiny bit off, it's really magnified in terms of what the results are. But I mean, obviously for him, a weekend to forget, and I'm kind of with you, like, if we're going to say he's not in the championship hunt at the end of the race, at the end of the year, let's just say for the sake of argument, that doesn't happen. Maybe you'd rather get crashed out at Gateway or somewhere else so that at least you could kind of be like, yeah, it's not my fault. Like, you know, it just wasn't meant to be, you know?
No, that weekend wasn't meant to be. With they brought a new setup package that didn't really work. They had Joseph was late to the weigh-in, so he had some lost time in practice. Their qualifying performance was poor, and he was one of the many Ganassi and Penske cars that just struggled in qualifying, and then obviously changed the engine before the race as well. So just basically everything that could possibly go wrong in a weekend really kind of went wrong.
Yeah, and like you said, I mean, this is a race that has, I feel like, more frequently than other races, gone, maybe not gone the entire, just like lights, hasn't gone lights to flag green, but, you know, has tended to be, you know, a good bet for a race on the calendar, you know, that once it kind of sorts itself out at the beginning, does go green for long periods of time, basically just because there are, I guess I would put it this way, there are not that many places that you can mess up and not be able to recover from it, kind of. Like, there's a lot of grass, there's a lot of places to have little errors and still keep it going. So yeah, for him, definitely a weekend to forget. For the Penske guys, just generally, I'd say the same.
I think it's kind of funny that 2/10 and a 9th will seal it for Pelot, and his worst finish of the season is 8th. Like,
right, yeah.
We're not looking good for everybody else. Yeah. Yeah, it's like basically the absolute worst case scenario of him being able to finish like worse than he has at any other point in the season and still win the championship is like pretty worrying. I did enjoy Tony DiZino, a good friend of the show, who actually appeared on the show in the off season last year to talk about some of the Road to Indy guys, tweeted that that Pelot has more contract disputes than finishes outside of the top 10 this season, which that one tickled me quite heavily, actually. I've got to be honest about that one.
So Jack, Graham Rahal back up on the point in qualifying, which I was super impressed by. Obviously, Rahal, you know, they managed to replicate what they did earlier in the season, which not everybody can say. So I think that probably all by itself was just a huge, I don't know if sigh of relief is the right word, but you know, it gave them a bolstered feeling just from practice one that what they had here, and this is a place so frequently that you can be good at one part of the year and just for no obvious reason be terrible or at least off target basically in the other race. So, you know, they clearly kind of had it going from the very beginning. Like you said, it's been 6 years basically since he took a pole. He was obviously, we talked about it earlier, within reach of a win here. Felt like lapped cars kind of played a role in that at the end. I guess I would say, you know, once the two of them were clear at the end of the race and Dixon kind of was back to, he obviously was allowed to go back to full rich. That last lap made me feel a little bit better about the lap cars not having played a huge role in the whole thing, because it sort of seemed like, okay, once Dixon's actually not saving fuel anymore, they've, you know, he's got kind of the pace and the tires to make this work for however long that was going to exist for. But, you know, you've kind of been around the paddock this year or the last couple of years. What's your sort of feeling from your point of view of how Graham is sort of looked at as a veteran IndyCar driver now? I mean, he's been around the sport for a long time. He's had his own sort of ups and downs. Some of that has very clearly been in line with the Rahal team's ups and downs. You know, he manages still to, every year he sort of manages to pull out these types of performances. I mean, obviously not quite to this exact level, but he's been here and he's been in the conversation, you know, throughout his kind of entire career, but maybe less frequently than I think he would have liked. So, you know, I guess I have some opinions about Graham and some thoughts just being around him a little bit more over the last couple of years, but I'm interested in your take on this first.
Yeah, I guess being specific to this race, I felt like this was a big breakthrough in terms of that we saw the pole in Mid-Ohio and the second in Mid-Ohio, he was almost on pole. I feel like we've seen, since he's not had a pole since 2017, over that period of time, we've seen him qualify very well. Obviously not score a pole, but we've seen him qualify high up and then not usually be able to kind of hold position, or we've seen him fall back in the races and not really been able to continue to challenge. I guess there's multiple different reasons for that. And we're talking about lots of different races here as a kind of blanket situation. So, you know, we're not going into too much detail, but I guess the fact that he's qualified well and not won a race shows you that he's not managed to, you know, deliver on that. And I guess the feeling is that he's a driver who hasn't won or had a pole in that period of time when his teammates have relatively frequently been able to do that, whether that was Takuma winning races in the time that he was Graham's teammate, or now we're starting to see Christian Lundgaard come to the fore and really start to challenge. But I guess my feeling is that he's a extremely underrated driver for what he kind of brings to the table. I think in terms of racecraft, there's not many better out there in terms of him. You very rarely see him kind of initiating any sort of like race-ending contact or putting himself in positions where you think you could have bailed out of that, or you could have been the person who, you know, kept that alive. Seems to be the kind of person who, if he does get taken out, it's like he's wiped out by something, as opposed to like putting himself in a bad position or anything that he's done wrong. I think he's earned the respect of the drivers around him. Christian Lundgaard disagreed with me, actually, to a certain extent, when I kind of asked if he felt that Graham was underrated, and he felt that the other drivers just all think Graham's very good and that he's not underrated. Maybe it's more of a media or a fan thing where Graham maybe doesn't get the credit he deserves. And he did say after his poll that there's a lot of hate out there from different people and from different areas about what he's done or his performances or how he goes about things or all that kind of stuff. But I just think the IndyCar series would be a much worse off without him. I think he's capable of really strong performances in the races. He's not not consistently been a threat for pole or wins for a little while now, but he's shown with this weekend that when the car is in the window, he is still capable of delivering those kind of performances. And also, I feel like he doesn't really get the credit for some of the other things that he does around the series either, in terms of, like, you look at the, obviously the fact that he's always tarnished with this kind of, you know, you drive for your dad's team situation, which he's talked about a million times, not just the media or me, but I found myself kind of sat there listening to him talk in the press conference after the pole and, like, looking at his overalls and thinking, like, at least two or three of the brands that are written on your overalls there that kind of mean that you're allowed to race this weekend are, like, relationships that you fostered, or, you know, brands you've gone out there and initiated the conversation with, or brought those sponsors into the team, or is one of the reasons why that brand continues to return. And you look at the Ray Hall car, there's so many sponsors on it, you can barely see, like, I feel like they're one step away from, like, the Fig Newtons on the aero screen at this point. Like, there's so many sponsors on the car. And I guess that's another area that Graham doesn't really maybe get the credit for is, you know, he's done a lot of work behind the scenes, whether that's on his own business, seeing how successful he's become as a businessman himself, or whether that's the kind of the business aspect of Ray Hall and how much he's helped that team from that perspective. I just think there's a lot of things he brings to the table that don't really get the credit that they deserve, I think. And there's a lot of things that make me think that he is a very underrated race driver, because he's not going to be someone who I'm going out there in silly season and thinking, right, I'm going to sign this guy and he's going to win two or three races a year and challenge for the championship for me. But is he a guy I think if I put him in, like, a Ganassi, Andretti, McLaren car now, would be a regular, like, top eight threat and would take points off all the other teams, you know, most weeks? I would say yes. That would be my opinion, that he would be that guy who would be able to do that and would bring that level of consistency. And, you know, he has driven for some of those teams in the past and not delivered the kind of performances that people have expected of him. But I think the level he's reached now, I think things might be a bit different. But I guess we maybe won't see that chance to look set that he's going to stay at the team for next season and probably for the long term. It makes a lot of sense. You know, not only is it the family team in that sense, but those brands that I mentioned, you know, quite a few of them have long-term relationships or would very much not like to see Graham leave the team. So there's lots of different aspects and mechanisms to that. But I thought this weekend was really refreshing from the point of view that he managed to stick with that kind of, he delivered the pole and then fought for the race win. And genuinely, I don't think there was a lot he could have done differently that would have won him that race. I just think it was a really unfortunate scenario that Scott Dixon was the one guy who was the kind of the one who pitted on lap five. And he's like the one person in the whole field who can make that strategy work, as we've kind of talked about.
Yeah, I agree. I think those are all really good points. You know, I do think that Graham's probably the guy that takes over this team from Bobby and, you know, ends up continuing on, sort of, you know, call it a legacy or whatever, but just carries on that business. And you can tell how embedded he is in this organization on so many levels. So regardless of, I mean, I'm not, you know, I think you have to separate who is Graham Ray Hall for the series and this team and why are those things the way that they are. And what is he as a driver when you want to kind of have these conversations. And I know that that's what you were doing as well, but, you know, sometimes I guess for the sake of the discussion in front of our listeners here, like, you know, we recognize that, right? Like when we're talking about Graham Ray Hall, you know, we realize that, you know, the fact that he is has taken the initiative in a way that many other drivers don't with this team is still secondary to the fact that, you know, to his results and his performances and all that kind of stuff. I think, you know, you see I think trying to be as kind of objective as possible, looking at Graham's, we'll just say sort of recent history or his recent career in the IndyCar series, really since he's been driving for Ray Hall Letterman, to your point, he's the peaks of that team's results have often been coming from somebody else. But every time that Taku was fast, Graham was right there. Every time that Christian's been fast, Graham is right there. He's usually not the slowest guy on the team. So he sort of, and that I think that Graham is a driver, I believe, and I don't know, this is, you know, don't hold me to this, I guess, but that he strikes me as a driver that maybe a little bit like we've sort of, you hear about guys like Simon Pagenaud and, you know, whatever, that they, to be really exceptional, kind of it all has to really click together. Like they really need to have exactly what they're looking for to be able to go and do that. When they have that, they're as good as anybody. But maybe not quite as, you know, we've talked about this even just between Graham and Christian a little bit over the last maybe 12 or 18 months between the two of those guys, basically just that it seems like Christian at times over the last year, like since the second half of last year, has been able to extract a little bit more out of a car that's kind of not doing what any of them really want it to do, right? So if there's anything to point to and say there's still room for Graham to get better or produce, you know, more consistently better results, I think it's that. But exactly to your point, it's not like when the thing isn't great that he's just DFL and his teammates are managing still to extract a lot more than he is out of it. And I guess I think for all of the things that he brings to the table at this point, which at this point includes just a wealth of experience in the series, he is kind of one of these guys that, you know, I imagine if you have open seats somewhere, he's in that conversation basically just for that reason. Like, you can plug this guy in and he's kind of a known commodity that is going to be able to get almost whatever anybody else is going to get out of the car, if not be able to stick you up in the top five when things are right. And to your point, like, it may be his results and his sort of existence in the series has not been flashy and spectacular over the last, you know, for over the last, call it 6 years here, basically. I mean, this period of time between his polls that we're talking about. But I would tend to agree with you that I think there's actually not that many guys. It's certainly not like guys that aren't in a full-time seat that you're sitting there thinking like, oh, he's using that up when somebody else deserves it. So I think, you know, Graham cares a lot about all of this stuff. It's interesting just to see, you know, his progress is the wrong word, just the sort of evolution of his attitude away from the car. You know, I mean, you can see that certainly part of that is related to him taking on more of a role within the team. And so you kind of sense the responsibility that he feels to his team and his team sponsors and all of those things. But, you know, it also just sort of feels like he's becoming one of these like not so old elder statesmen within the series as far as drivers go. And so I'm happy for him to be able to come out, take a swing here, basically, to be able to show that, okay, whatever is going on, regardless of how perfect it needs to be or something, for him to be the fastest guy on track again, like, he's still capable of doing that. And to your point, to get through the race, in essence, like, with, you know, kind of a finger or two tied behind his back because of the tire issue that they talked to, just not having another set of good alternates because he flat spotted him or whatever in qualifying, to have the pace that he did. I mean, I felt like at the start of the race, you got the sense that Christian really thought that he was going to be the guy to give Graham a run for his money, that you sort of almost had the feeling that in Christian's mind, he was just waiting for his chance to pounce. Obviously, they had a long pit stop in the first go around, and that really was the thing ultimately it felt like that kind of took him, or it certainly knocked him back, you know, half a step in terms of being able to take the fight to Graham. But basically nobody ended up being able to take the fight to Graham. So, you know, I think that basically just goes to show that he definitely still has this form.
I also just wanted to mention, because I was the one who brought up Takuma and mentioned him, and he is like the one person, I think, since 2017 that you can make a realistic argument that has performed like to a higher level than Graham. But in all of those years after that, only 1 year did Takuma outscore Graham in the championship. And that was 2020 when Takuma won the 500, when it was double points. And I mean, Graham was third in that year. So he still scored, you know, a fair amount of points from the 500. It wasn't the only thing that decided that kind of switch around, but I think that's a pretty good record against someone like Takuma to, you know, to beat him in the championship every year, apart from one. And the 1 year to not do it was the year he won the 500. And we all know, you know, how Graham feels about 2021, and he could have won that 500. That could have been, you know, a big thing for his kind of resume as well. I think this year is going to be the first year where he's like quite a significant distance behind a teammate for a long time. And even so, we've still seen some of the peaks like we saw this weekend from Graham. So I definitely don't think this is like the beginning of a decline or or anything like that. I think we've seen the emergence of probably a future IndyCar champion, or at least a regular race winner in Christian Lundgaard, and that's probably not kind of helping a difficult Graham Rahal year in terms of looking at the points, but I've still been really impressed with what I've seen anyway.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
One person we haven't really spoken about at length yet is Alex Palou. Are you ready for this, JR? Take a deep breath, and we're going to go on a magical mystery ride through the podcast wonderland that is the Palou Down, as it is christened. I don't even know where exactly to start this story, but I guess chronologically would be the exact way forward. I guess in terms of the race, he was quite nondescript, just to get to that before we kind of get into the whole contract situation. I feel like he was kind of like, he was there, but not really there. And I feel like that whole kind of basically fourth, fifth, maybe on backwards from the top 10 were kind of guys who you felt like could fall back or move forward. And it was kind of going to be decided by, you know, kind of towards the end of the race and how they were in the last stint and stuff like that. Alex was seventh in the end, a decent result, obviously not his worst result of the season.
But almost.
Yeah, almost. You could suggest that he caused that incident with Marcus Armstrong. I think it'd be reasonable to put the blame on him for that. And also,
you're welcome, Scott Dixon.
Yeah. And almost took himself out of the race, smashing into Devlin DeFrancesco at turn 11 early on in the race as well, which was, he was lucky to get away with that one as well. So fortunate to be able to bring the car home after those incidents and be in a position to do what he did. I guess we said we would start this chronologically. So if you've been living under a rock and don't know what has happened on Saturday morning. I don't know what time it was in the US, but it was about 1 a.m. in the UK because it kept me up for a significant amount of time. That's why I remember that. But we had the Associated Press, Jenna Fryer, broke a story which basically revealed a letter that had allegedly been sent by Zak Brown to the Arrow McLaren employees. It said a lot of different things, but the crux of it was, and was followed up with a statement which was sent to quite a few different media outlets by McLaren or from McLaren, from Zak Brown, which basically said, "I'm extremely disappointed that Alex Palou does not intend to honour his contractual obligations to race with us in IndyCar in 2024 and beyond." That's all I have to say on the topic for some time. So that was the first public confirmation from anyone that Alex Palou had a written contract with McLaren in any way, shape or form. Obviously, after what happened last year with the whole Palou and McLaren and Ganassi situation, we knew that there was an exclusivity clause in Alex Palou's contract that lasted until September the 1st, 2023. So none of us expected to hear anything about Palou signing for McLaren. But basically since last year, it's been the worst kept secret in IndyCar that Alex Palou would sign for McLaren. And more recently, the alleged sort of existence of this contract with McLaren has been one of the kind of underpinning reasons for people being able to say that, because they know that there's been, you know, some sort of deal in place between the two, which Palou has now reportedly informed Zak Brown that he won't be driving for McLaren next year. That was then, another element of that we should probably outline was, as part of the Associated Press's story, part of that letter said that, this was Zak Brown talking, said, "We have paid Palou a significant first payment towards his 2024 season," which I found bizarre, JR. I could not believe that Palou's already been paid for part of the 2024 season, according to Zak Brown. And also talked about the millions of dollars that they've spent to help develop him via its F1 testing program and all of that kind of stuff. So that was another element to it. Then we got news that Chip Ganassi was releasing his own statement. I'll give you that in full because it's quite an interesting statement. I think it'd be remiss to just kind of refer to this. I think we should read it out. So it reads, "Anyone that knows me knows that I don't make a habit of commenting about contract situations. Subsequently, I have been quiet since day one of this story, but now I feel I must respond. I grew up respecting the McLaren team and their success. The new management does not get my same respect. Alex Palou has been part of our team and under contract since 2021 season. It is the interference of that contract from McLaren that began this process, and ironically, they are now playing the victim. Simply stated, the position of McLaren IndyCar regarding our driver is inaccurate and wrong. He remains under contract with CGR. And shortly after that, Alex Palou's management, Monaco Increase management, which have been looking after him since last season when he made the announcement that he was going to leave for McLaren in the first place, said that it was disappointed that Alex has decided to break that agreement. And the statement didn't say this explicitly, but kind of implies that they're going their separate ways, and that's been confirmed since. So Palou's lost his management, and I guess all of this points towards him likely staying at Ganassi. So that's the kind of outline, JR. I guess as you saw this unfold, did you kind of have flashbacks to last year and were just kind of feeling like you were not surprised at any of this kind of coming out because of what happened last year? Like, it's just like when I saw this hit my inbox and this started to like fire off, obviously we'd heard some stuff in the week before, but weren't really sure about what was true and what wasn't. And then this kind of comes into your inbox. And if it's any other driver in the world, apart from maybe Oscar Piastri, you probably think, oh, wow, this is incredible. But this came in, I was just like, oh, right, so this is the latest installment of this debacle.
Yeah, it's interesting to try to unpack the why of it being this way. I think there's basically just too many question marks and to really even, from my perspective at least, to really even speculate on that. You know, I think that it's on the one hand, the idea that he's staying at Ganassi doesn't seem crazy at all. Like we talked about that from the very beginning of this whole thing, as did many others, that seems like that the path to F1 as a part of the carrot that's being dangled on the McLaren side seems like an extremely low odds like thing to play out. There is zero obvious pathway, right? For where the chips currently sit, there is zero pathway for Alex to end up in a race seat in F1 right now. So it would appear, basically. Obviously, we know how quickly from the various sort of F1 contracts and driver movement and whatever, like we know how quickly that also can change. And being a dominant IndyCar champion has in the past for other drivers, Alex Zanardi, Juan Pablo Montoya, whatever, like this has been a part of how they've managed to end up getting those opportunities. Yeah, it seemed like, why would you leave the place that you're currently kicking ass at, basically? Like that doesn't seem like an obvious answer there. I guess the obvious answer was, well, because you're getting paid a lot more. And so I guess I'm willing to at least make some assumptions here in terms of what's gone on, which are basically that Chip has come around and decided that he's going to pay Alex whatever his market value is here, maybe, and then some. We talked earlier this year in the context of Marcus Ericsson, which is, I guess, a whole nother kind of, you know, adjacent component to what's happening here, that maybe it has to do with it, maybe it sort of doesn't, but you know, you got to figure that one of my questions with respect to Ericsson that we talked about just sort of off air was maybe Chip thinks that Alex is still in the frame and is treating it as such and knows something that we don't in terms of his ability to actually make that happen, and just can't pay both of them, basically. Like that is definitely one simple explanation for why Palou is still here and why Ericsson, you know, we're sort of making the assumption that he's not, like that he's going to be somewhere else getting into next year. I don't know that, but if that were to be the case, this could simply be dollars and cents that they need to fill that seat with somebody who's bringing some money to offset Dixon and Palou, basically. Like that would not be Chip Ganassi Racing, unlike Penske or even McLaren or in other parts of the racing universe. You know, you've got Hendrick and, you know, these other businesses, certainly in F1, that are backed by businesses that are 10 or 100 times greater than these teams are. Chip Ganassi Racing is not one of those. So, you know, there's definitely a lot of things that sort of factor into this. I guess, you know, just to sort of talk about it going down this weekend, I was surprised by it, basically. Like, I do think at this point, I was surprised just by this being the outcome. I feel like at this point, basically I don't think you're talking about a huge difference between the performance of Ganassi and Arrow McLaren at this point. Like, Arrow McLaren arguably has more resources at their disposal to continue getting better. You know, so I guess from my perspective, yeah, the fact that it became like this just total shit show, that part of it, maybe given the fact that we've been through that once, it did feel like, oh, we're just, okay, let's get back on the merry-go-round and like see when it stops, you know, and see where everybody's at. But in a weird way, the actual outcome of this whole thing after 2 years of it going down, or a year and a half of it going down, is a surprise. What's your take on that? Like, are you surprised that this is how this actually ended up? If we're just talking about Palou ending up back at Ganassi, like, does that part of this surprise you?
Well, like, even some of my colleagues, when Palou won Laguna Seca last year by like 30 seconds, were asking like, why is he leaving this team? And like, he's gone on to like ram that down people's throats even more this year with how successful he's been with Ganassi. But I guess you kind of have to follow this in a linear fashion to try and unpack it, because I guess when Palou made his decision that he was going to leave for McLaren, there was the opportunity of Formula One testing and maybe even potentially a Formula One seat. There was the obvious expansion that was going on at McLaren with a lot of excitement around it, a lot of obvious upsides to the team, some of the drivers that they were looking at signing or even had signed at that point. And the decision didn't seem wildly outrageous based on the fact that he was clearly getting a big salary bump and was going to be playing around in some Formula One cars. Like, that sounds like a good double combo for a racing driver to take, if we're just being honest about things.
Yeah, totally.
But I guess as we've gone through this season, it's become more and more apparent that Ganassi is still quite a significant amount ahead of Arrow McLaren. And I guess you can look at this in many different ways. You could argue that McLaren probably should have won 3 or 4 races this year, potentially. But they haven't, is the top and bottom of things. However you kind of want to break this down. If we're just talking about what has and hasn't happened, we can go back and change as many results as we want, but they haven't won a race. Ray Hall's won a race this season and Arrow McLaren hasn't, which seems like a bizarre thing that you wouldn't have said at the start of the year based on their performance. Other things have become clear, that there's no seat in F1. So whatever happens, if AlphaTauri or Williams do want to make a move for Palou in this offseason, it's going to come late, and it's going to mean that they're going to have to buy out his contract for an IndyCar team, because Palou is not going to wait until January or February to have an IndyCar ride for next season. He will have signed and will have an IndyCar ride. So whether he's at Ganassi or McLaren, he's going to need to get bought out by an F1 team for him to go to F1.
Yeah, and exactly. And neither of those F1 teams is named McLaren. So
precisely,
like, it's neither here nor there which team he's signed up with.
So your destination does not matter. So when you add all that up and you work out how dominant he's been this season, I guess the other thing I didn't mention as well was that last season, I guess, was kind of up and down. Definitely not as dominant as this season, obviously, because he didn't win the championship. And his Laguna Seca win actually bumped him a couple of positions in the standings. Had he not had that win, you know, he could have been 6th or 7th in the championship at the end of the year, which I guess is another reason to think that maybe the grass was greener with McLaren and that it was worth the move over. So I think we've kind of agreed on the thing that we're not surprised that this would be the logical or like the chosen direction that Palou would want to go in. If he was just sat there and someone said to him, who do you want to drive for in IndyCar next year? I think you would say Ganassi every day of the week. As much as people might want to talk about buying into the long-term project at McLaren, et cetera, et cetera. I actually believe that McLaren in like 3 or 4 years is going to be like right up there, if not the best team in IndyCar. But I personally think the drawback is that they're in a shop that was designed for to run two cars, the old Schmidt-Peterson shop. They're now currently running 3 full-time cars and a full-time car for Indy out there. And they're not going to be in their new factory until 2025. So it stopped them from expanding for next season. They can't have 4 cars next season full-time because they just don't have the room or the resources to be able to fit all of the people in there and to do all of that stuff. So I think even in that sense of McLaren, I think there'll be massive players on the 2024-25 silly season market, because when they've got the new factory, they'll expand, they'll have room for the people, they'll be running out of the Andretti shop, which runs 4 cars and has run 5 cars, as well as extra cars at Indy as well. And they've shown that they have the resources. They're currently paying 3 drivers. And, you know, Zach has talked about being very confident in the kind of the business side of things at McLaren and being able to make that work and how strong IndyCar has become for them in terms of the business side. So I think 2024, 25, they're going to be massive players in the silly season market. I could see them going after absolutely any driver they want to basically at that point and trying to make a big statement. But as we stand at the moment, if you're Alex Plow, you're probably looking at it and thinking the only way McLaren moves forward next year is just through continuity, which is not necessarily something you'd want to bet on when you're already at a team that is, you know, has had the kind of linear progression that Ganassi has. So I guess there's two other things that kind of interest me in this. The first was that I was kind of perplexed a little bit by Ganassi's decision to make a statement when they did, especially as he starts a statement by saying, I don't usually talk about these kind of things. So it's like my immediate kind of thought of that was like, why start now then? Because the kind of problem for me in that is, and I've written a piece about this, you can read it on The Race if you're interested, came out on Sunday morning, that Alex Plow has been, you know, if there is a written contract, which it seems like everyone's talking about, there is one, and even regardless of any said contract, even in his tweets last year that said he wanted to move to McLaren, Alex Plow has been complicit in this all along, like the whole thing. And for Ganassi to come out and criticise McLaren for their conduct and not really mention Plow in that, to me, it's just a bit like disingenuous is how I take that personally. And I understand, I got a million tweets of people saying, well, obviously he's not going to criticise his own driver. And a few other people are kind of saying like, oh, he's the driver. He's got all the power. He's the one who's winning the championship. He's the one who's, you know, in that position. And I totally do not argue with any of that. That is all totally correct. But the fact of the matter is that statement didn't need to be made. And the fact that it was and criticised McLaren and not Palou, I just felt that was a bit kind of disingenuous. And that Alex has got, you know, Alex has been criticised by his management and by McLaren. But I'm not sure the fans have kind of, I think some of the fans reading the Ganassi statement are kind of like jumping on McLaren when I feel like Alex Plow has got as much to do with this as anyone personally. I don't think that's an outrageous statement to make. And as I've written in my column, I'm a big fan of Alex. I like spending time with him and think he's a really cool guy. I've had him on the pod loads of times and he's always really nice on here and always like, he's always like off air. He's always asking like how we're doing and what we're up to. And, you know, like in the paddock and his team, like his team absolutely adore him. Like they love him, all of the crew guys and everything that he worked. Even after all of this, they still love it. Everything about him, they just love. So it's not like a personal attack on Alex Plow. I just think I'm just surprised that he's not got the same level of kind of, maybe not criticism, but just like acknowledgement that he's got a role to play in all of this. Like he is the driver. He does have a role in it. And the other interesting element is, what do McLaren do now? Like we're late in silly season here. Like we're almost close to a few of the top guys being off the market. You know, I think a few people are getting, well, we're getting closer and closer to thinking that Marcus was off to Andretti, even though Ganassi had supposedly made him a final offer. You were right about Palou getting another offer, by the way, according to our sources, at least in the last couple of months, he'd had a new offer from Chip. And that was one of the things that kind of kickstarted all of this, I guess. But if I'm Zach, I'm trying to sign Marcus as quickly as possible and get him in the car, you know. I think there's a lot of options that McLaren can do to try and drag this out now, but none of them end well for McLaren because they're going to end up, you know, if they try and desperately try and take Palou, best case, they sign him and they've got a driver that didn't want to move there. And, you know, worst case, they're a few months down the line with no resolution to the whole thing and there's no drivers left on the market at an elite level because they've all been taken by other teams. So I think that's a really interesting element of the next kind of equation. I think it's very, very likely that McLaren will sign Felix Rosenqvist again or go with Marcus if they can sign him. You know, talked about how much they like Felix and he might be relatively inconsistent, but we've seen what his upside can be. And I think, as I mentioned, if they do go big in the 24-25 market, then signing Felix for another year gives them that opportunity to be a bit more flexible and make some big decisions in the off-season next year. So those are the kind of things that I think sound sensible for how this is kind of going to play out. Whether McLaren do go for Marcus, you know, we don't know that yet. We don't even know if McLaren have started to look at other drivers yet or if they've spoken to other drivers. My suggestion would be that they probably have and have probably started this move in and got the ball rolling because they won't want to be left in the lurch in terms of, you know, looking for another top driver. So I guess hopefully we've tried to answer some of your likely biggest questions about how all of this kind of plays out and what has happened, what hasn't happened, what can we talk about, what can't we talk about, and what might happen next. So yeah, I guess that's the latest pull update, or the pull down, on the Race IndyCar podcast. I'm glad we brought it back. Gives us something extra to talk about off track, because it felt like, up until that point at least, a fairly quiet weekend in terms of it has been the last couple of weekends, trying to work out who's going where and who's doing what in the silly season. We're starting to get a bit more of a clear framework. And I think Linus Lundqvist, our guest last week, you can go back and listen to the interview we had with him, did himself no favours with his 12th place finish. He'd qualified really well again and did a pretty fantastic job. We were really happy to obviously see some of those things that he was talking about, looking forward to getting under his belt, whether it just be like a race pit stop, which he'd only done for the first time last Sunday, not in practice, which was a big deal for him. Lots of the other things you can go and read about. He was 12th, wasn't he? Yeah, he was 12th in the race. That's right. And qualified well as well. So I'm sure he's played himself into the market. We also had the news. We can't finish the pod without the kind of the worst like timed announcement ever, based on everything that happened with Alex Flo. But we now know that Tom Blomqvist is definitely going to be racing for Mayer-Schenck full time next year. Something that we've been talking about on the pod and on the pages of the race since May. That is now confirmed, and it will be a full time ride. He's not doing just the road and street courses or anything like that. So he's going to try ovals for the first time. And Helio Castroneves is moving to a kind of leadership role within Mayer-Schenck, and he'll have a go at winning his fifth Indy 500 with an Indy 500 only entry for Mayer-Schenck, three cars there next year. So that'll be interesting how they manage that. They've struggled with two cars, I've got to say, expanding to two cars for full time. So how they manage three cars will be interesting. And Mike Schenck is a racer. He knows that what they've done with two cars has not been where he wants to be, or has not really been good enough for, the team and where they want to be. So he's definitely, I'm not saying anything that he doesn't know there. And it was one of the things they were thinking about when they were deciding whether they would go with three cars. So they've got a lot of work to do to get all the right people in place and get all of that kind of program kicked off. So yeah, that'll be interesting. So I guess with a busy weekend, you can head over to the-race.com to read all of the latest news features. You can read a race report on Dixon's win, and you can read what feels like 90 Alex Palou features on the pages of the race from over the course of the weekend. And we're also recording this during or just as the NASCAR race finishes. So I'm pretty sure if you head over to the race after the NASCAR race is finished, there'll be a little report there talking about how the likes of Kamui Kobayashi and Jenson Button have got on in their debut and return respectively. So that's all for this episode of the Race IndyCar podcast.